The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Let's respond to that.
Well, we're, okay, let's start. So the first two pages of the introduction tells you the 13 areas covered, but we're not going to go through the 13 areas covered because we're only going to go through the first five. So this, let's look at the first five to get an idea of what we're going to be doing over the next few hours. First thing we're going to cover is personal jurisdiction, right, to figure out. We're going to follow along in our study of civil procedures based the way you did it in your federal procedure, which we're going to go through it as you would if you were actually starting a lawsuit. Things, the issues that would come as you progress through the lawsuit, you're going to study them in that order. So one of the first things you're going to try to figure out as a plaintiff is whether you're going to have a jurisdiction over your defendant in Maryland. We're going to talk about the Maryland basis of jurisdiction, right? There are specific statutory bases that we're going to talk about. In addition to figuring out whether it's statutorily authorized in Maryland, we're going to see whether it's constitutionally permissible. So we'll talk a little bit about the constitutional requirements that come into play when trying to figure out whether you can exercise jurisdiction. We'll also be talking about interim jurisdiction as an alternative. That's quickly and very important because that doesn't come up that often. Subject matter jurisdiction is different from what you might be used to in your federal procedure. Subject matter jurisdiction for us in Maryland is really a question of whether it goes to circuit court, which is the trial court that handles the bigger cases, or whether it goes to district court. So we'll talk about the different requirements for getting into a circuit court or district court. We'll also talk about jury trials, which are only available in circuit court. Once we figure out whether we're in circuit court or district court, we've got to figure out which circuit court we're going to go into or which district court. That's a venue question. So the venue basically is an inquiry into what court or courts, a particular court system, are available to us. So that's venue. We'll also talk about forum nonconvenience for a little bit, which is a related issue. Those are the three things that go together. Those are the things we think about when we're trying to figure out whether to start the lawsuit, personal jurisdiction, subject matter, venue. After that, we're going to start a lawsuit. We're going to talk about service of process. Service of process, we're going to talk about when we serve the person, when we have to serve, who can serve, who has to be served, et cetera. Methods of challenging service. After that, we're going to be talking about pleadings and preliminary motion. Once we've gotten our lawsuit started, we figure out where to bring it, who to, how to serve, et cetera, we're going to try to figure out what would be our next step. Well, the first step usually is that the plaintiff's going to serve a complaint. Then we're going to talk about what the responses are. Well, we could have an answer, preliminary motion, we serve a counterclaim, et cetera. So that's the type of thing we'll be talking about in that section. Let's just skip over the next page and talk about personal jurisdiction for a second for a while. Personal jurisdiction is what question? We're trying to figure out whether we can bring this defendant into a Maryland court. That's the question that we ask ourselves when we're trying to figure out personal jurisdiction. There's always two parts to this inquiry. The first step is always to figure out whether there's a basis for it under Maryland law or not. Okay, so the first step of our inquiry as to whether we can exercise jurisdiction over a person in Maryland court is whether it's authorized under Maryland law. Even if it is authorized under Maryland law, we still have to figure out whether it's constitutional under the due process clause of the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, right? That's international civil law, that other stuff that we remember a little bit from our federal course. That's the second step. Let's talk about the first step for a while, Maryland basis of in personam jurisdiction. There are five bases that we're going to be talking about. The first one is consent. That's up there all by itself because that's not a statute. That's just someone consenting to jurisdiction. The next four are all contained in statutes. Domicile. The next line is domestic corporations and partnerships. Presence is our third one, our fourth one rather, and law. What are they? You don't have to copy anything now. We'll go through the detail. Domicile means our defendant is living in Maryland. Okay, he's domiciled in Maryland. Domestic corporation These are corporations with either incorporated in Maryland or a simple place of business is there. Presence being our defendant was in Maryland at the time we handed him process. That's what we can get. Long arm is a series of it's a statute that these various incidents, various activities that would subject a person to jurisdiction in Maryland, provided the claim arises from one of those specified activities. So let's go through it. First one is consent. Defendant consents to personal jurisdiction in Maryland. Okay. Now, defendant can consent by contract, right? You and I can enter into a contract, and part of that contract has a provision in it that says, in the event there's a lawsuit, the parties consent to the jurisdiction of the courts of the state of Maryland. That's one form of consent. Another form of consent is when you appoint a registered agent in Maryland as part of a governmental application, appointment of a registered agent to serve as a process. One thing to remember is the appointment of a registered agent does not constitute consent to personal jurisdiction for a claim arising outside of Maryland. It basically has been interpreted as allowing somebody to bring a claim in Maryland, okay, based on that registration for activities in Maryland. I'm a corporation, I'm registering to do business in Maryland, right? I can be sued in Maryland because I appointed, the state of Maryland as my registered agent for service for incidents, okay, arising from my activities in Maryland. Let's go through this to figure out what it means in a concrete sense. Let's do question one. D, a Florida resident, signs a contract that provides that any dispute arising under the contract must be adjudicated in Maryland. Now, P sues a D in Maryland for breach of contract. Is that okay? It's going to give us the opportunity to talk about some exceptions. That's why we have a lot of lines here. Yes. The answer is yes. A forum selection clause. That's what that is, right? It's a forum selection clause. They're selecting Maryland. Forum selection clauses are enforceable unless the contract was induced by fraud. One, the contract was induced by fraud. Two, the selected form is very unfair or inconvenient to D. Two, the selected form is very unfair or inconvenient to D, to defendant. Or three, enforcement would contravene a strong public policy of Maryland. Three, enforcement would contravene a strong public policy of Maryland. For instance, a lawsuit might be involved in an out-of-state statute that allows something that would be prohibited under Maryland law. So even though there's a form selection clause that places the defendant in Maryland, Maryland will, of course, be inclined to enforce that form selection. Let's look at question two. D, a North Carolina corporation, has no offices in Maryland and does not transact business in Maryland. It has, however, appointed a registered agent for service of process in order to operate trucks on interstate highways in Maryland. P sues D in Maryland for damages suffered by P in an auto accident in North Carolina. Is that okay? It's not okay, right? Because we talked before about the registered agent being appointed only for claims arising in Maryland, things related to the appointment. So the answer is no. The appointment of a registered agent in Maryland, no, the appointment of a registered agent in Maryland is consent to jurisdiction to claims arising in Maryland, comma, not other states. Once again, the appointment of a registered agent in Maryland is consent to jurisdiction to claims arising in Maryland, not in other states. Okay, that's consent. Let's go into our four statutory bases. By the way, you in the past, Maryland on the bars, they give you extracts. So they'll give you a copy of the statutory materials that you need. So there's really, if things go as they have gone in the past, there's going to be no reason to memorize the statutes. you need to be familiar with their scope and what they're about, so you see them. But when you get questioned regarding personal jurisdiction, you will presumably get they call it an extract, which is copies of the statutes that would confer jurisdiction. Let's look at domicile. Four things we want to remember, four rules. If the defendant is domiciled in Maryland, he can be sued in Maryland on unrelated claims. Okay, one thing about being domiciled in Maryland, it gives what we call general jurisdiction. Our defendant is domiciled in Maryland can be sued for anything. It doesn't have to relate to his being in Maryland. So let's look at question three just to illustrate that point. Defendant is a Maryland domiciliary. P sues D in Maryland for damages suffered by P in an auto accident in New York. Now, P is suing him for an auto accident that occurred in New York. And P, for all we know, it doesn't say, P might be from an entirely different state. Is that okay? Yeah, it might seem counterintuitive, but yes. Okay, if D is domiciled in Maryland, he can be sued in Maryland on any claim by anyone, even a non-Maryland resident. Yes, if D is domiciled in Maryland, he can be sued in Maryland on any claim by anyone, even a non-Maryland resident. When do we figure out domicile? They'll tell you the facts that people be moving all over the place. What's the date that you're worried about? You're worried about the date of the commencement of the lawsuit. That's the date you look at to figure out when a person is domiciled for purposes of jurisdiction. D, domiciliary, Maryland, question four. Injures P in a car accident in New York. P then changes his domicile to Texas. P sues D in Maryland for his injuries. Can a Maryland court assert personal jurisdiction over D on the basis of his domicile? Well, the answer is no, because D was domiciled in Texas when the lawsuit was commenced. Another thing, no, because D was domiciled in Texas when the lawsuit was commenced. Third rule, every natural person, okay, we're talking about people, every natural person has just one domicile. You don't have more than one domicile. And you change your domicile, two things take place. When you take up residence, okay, in Maryland, if you're becoming a domiciliary, when you take up residence in Maryland, and second thing, you intend to remain a resident of Maryland permanently, or for at least an unlimited time. Let's go to question five to see how that works. D, domiciliary of Massachusetts, accepts a position as a one-year appointment. One year appointment as a visiting professor at a Maryland university and moves to Baltimore. Is D now a domiciliary of Maryland, or is he still a domiciliary of Massachusetts? He's going to be Massachusetts. The answer is no, because he is only temporarily in Maryland. He does not intend to live there permanently. Okay, the answer again is no, because he is only temporarily in Maryland. He does not intend to live there permanently. Question six is the flip side of it. D is a domiciliary of Massachusetts. He decides to move to Maryland permanently. He has the intent. On his way to Maryland, he dies in a car accident in New York. At that moment, is D a domiciliary of Massachusetts or Maryland? The answer is Massachusetts, because he has not yet set up his residence in Maryland. Massachusetts, because he has not yet set up his residence in Maryland. Now the fact pattern, the essay is not going to say he's domiciled here, or he intends to permanently take up residence here. It's going to give you facts. How do we figure out whether someone makes his, where someone's making his residence? Can we look at these objective factors? Where he lives, where he votes, where he's paying his taxes, where his driver's license is issued. So those are things we would look at in the fact pattern to try to assess where someone was permanently residing. So if I move to another state that I don't change any of those things,
probably I haven't left my old dumps not long.
Now that's for people, right? For corporations and partnerships, a person has only one domicile at a time. A corporation has two domiciles for our purposes, right? We're not going to call it domiciles. We're going to think of it that way. A domestic corporation is subject to personal jurisdiction in Maryland for any claim if it was incorporated in Maryland, right? It's a Maryland corporation, or it has its principal place of business in Maryland. So that's almost like being, I think of it as domicile, but it's a separate statute, they don't call it domicile. But a corporation that's incorporated in Maryland, has its principal place of business in Maryland, just like a person who's living, who's domiciled in Maryland, he can be sued. That corporation can be sued in Maryland just for the activities in Maryland. No, that corporation can be sued in Maryland for anything. Again, it's another form of what we call it, general jurisdiction. A partnership is the same thing. A partnership is subject to personal jurisdiction in Maryland for any claim if it has its principal place of business in Maryland. Let's look at question 7, see if we can understand it, how it works. Bubba's Biscuits Incorporated has a Delaware corporation with its principal place of business in Georgia. It has an office in Maryland and engages in substantial interstate and interstate commerce here. It is sued in Maryland on a breach of contract claim unrelated to Maryland. Bubba's Biscuits is not subject to personal jurisdiction based on domicile. It's not domicile, based on it being a domestic corporation. I call it domicile all the time. It's really not being a domestic corporation. Why? Well, it was not incorporated in Maryland, and its principal place of business is in Georgia, not Maryland. It was not incorporated in Maryland, and its principal place of business is in Georgia, not Maryland. Well, does that mean that Bubba's Biscuits is never, we're never going to be able to sue Bubba's Biscuits in Maryland? No, we're going to investigate all bases, and the last basis, the long-run statute, is going to give us an opportunity to get Bubba's Biscuits, and we'll return to this question and see if that works. So those are our two statutory bases so far, domicile, and the one that's sort of like domicile for corporations and partnerships, whether they're incorporated or have a principal place of business there if it's a corporation, whether it has a principal place of business there if it's a partnership. Let's look at presence. Presence is also like domicile and domestic corporations in that it is a form of general jurisdiction.
What do I mean? What's the difference? We'll go into it again, but just generally, what's the difference between general jurisdiction and specific jurisdiction? General jurisdiction is when the activity that we're looking at, right, there's no need for that activity to be related to my claim as plaintiff. And you could be domiciled here, or you're a domestic corporation, or you're present in the state when you served. My claim as plaintiff doesn't have to relate to your connection to Maryland if your connection is that you're a domiciliary. That's what general jurisdiction is about. When we get to the long-arm statute, we'll see that there are other things that subject you to jurisdiction. Okay, but that's the concept of specific jurisdiction. If I want to sue you, okay, and I want to exercise jurisdiction over you for one of the things that's listed in the long-arm statute, I have to make sure that my claim relates to the item in the long-arm statute that I'm relying on. That's specific jurisdiction. It's not jurisdiction generally for all purposes. It's jurisdiction for this specific type of claim.
Presence, again, a form of general jurisdiction. Defendant is in Maryland when served with process. So this is basically a gotcha, right? He's not domiciled in Maryland, but when you serve him with a summons and complaint, he's in Maryland. And that's the basis of jurisdiction. So this is the general rule. If a defendant is a natural person, okay, it doesn't apply. We're not talking about corporations or partnerships here. If a defendant is a natural person and is present in Maryland when served, he can be sued in Maryland on unrelated claims. That's our general jurisdiction concept again. Let's look at question 8. D, a Georgia resident, is served with process while attending a poetry reading in Baltimore. A peace claim arises from an auto accident in Delaware. May Maryland court exercise personal jurisdiction over D on the basis of presence? The answer is yes. Okay. D is present in Maryland. he can be sued in a Maryland court on any claim, even if the claim is unrelated to Maryland. Yes, if D is present in Maryland, he can be sued in a Maryland court on any claim, even if the claim is unrelated to Maryland. There's an exception to this rule, okay, that a court can exercise jurisdiction just because we got you passing through. D cannot be served with process if he is in Maryland to testify, prosecute, or defend an action, or if he's passing through Maryland to testify in another state pursuant to a subpoena. So if either of those things are happening at the time our defendant is served, the presence cannot be a valid basis to exercise personal jurisdiction. Again, what do I mean when I say personal jurisdiction? A court can't tell you to come into the court, okay, and do something, and appear in court and defend, unless it has the power to do so. Okay, the power to do so is enumerated in Maryland statutes, right? So that's what we're talking about here, is personal jurisdiction or not. The second thing we're going to think about is whether this particular exercise of jurisdiction is constitutional, whether it's fair. So we're not thinking about that right now. We're just thinking about whether there's authority for it. That's the first thing we think about. Let's look at question 9. On his way, en route to New York to testify at a civil trial, D stops at a local diner in Baltimore and is served with process in an action in Maryland court. Does D's presence in Baltimore make him subject to the Maryland court's personal jurisdiction? Well, the answer starts with, it depends. What does it depend on? It depends on whether he is testifying in New York pursuant to a subpoena. It depends on whether he is testifying in New York pursuant to a subpoena. If he is a subpoenaed witness, he can't be served in Maryland. Could be served in Maryland, but it would be a way of exercising personal jurisdiction. Okay, let's look at the next page, which has the items that we have to think about for the long arm statute. Now, all of these, as we said, you're going to get a copy of the long arm statute in front of you. The trick with going to personal jurisdiction question is not to look for a single basis of jurisdiction, but to ask yourself whether, you know, any of the ones we talked about are met, and then when you get to the long arm statute, to ask which, okay, of these may afford the court a basis to exercise jurisdiction of the defendant. It's often going to be more than one. So when we find one, we're not going to stop there. Okay, let's look at the long arm statute. Notice it says in parens, all are bases for specific personal jurisdiction, right? Okay. Which means that the cause of action must arise, underline must arise, I italicize it, but he has it, must arise from one of the following activities. These are our activities. Let's pay attention to them because we're going to do some exercises just to see if we understand what's going on. D transacts any business or performs any work or service in Maryland. And after each one of these, you have to say, and P's claims arise out of that activity. D contracts to supply goods, foods, services, or manufactured products in Maryland. And the cause of action arises out of it. D causes a tortious injury in the state by an act or omission in Maryland. Let's look at D. D causes a tortious injury in the state or outside of the state. So you cause an injury in Maryland or outside of Maryland by an act or omission outside of Maryland. Seems a little constitutionally iffy, but we're not worrying about that right now. We're just trying to understand the provision of the long arm statute. Provided D satisfies the plus factor, D regularly does business in Maryland or derives substantial revenue from goods or services used or consumed in the state. Now, notice that plus factor, that need not be connected to the to P's claim. The plus factor is independent of a P's claim. So that's our exception, or our general advice. We have to make sure that the activity we're talking about, the law must actually relate to the plaintiff's claim. D has an interest in, uses or possesses real property in the state. D contracts to insure risks in Maryland. Okay, D is an insurer. This is a matrimonial type cases. D is a defendant in a domestic relations case for child support, alimony, or attorney's fees, and the plaintiff resides in Maryland. The couple's domicile immediately before the separation was Maryland, and the payment obligation arose under Maryland. So those are three things we're looking at in that domestic relations case: child support, alimony, or attorney's fees. One, the plaintiff resides in Maryland. Two, the couple's domicile immediately before the separation was Maryland. And three, the payment obligation arose under Maryland law and agreement executed by one of the parties. Okay, let's go through some of the questions here. And this is what you're going to have to do on the exam, so you might as well do it now just to see if you got the hang of it. We got these five, more than five, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 different items listed here. What we're going to do is we're going to give you some questions, and I want you to tell me what basis or bases of jurisdiction are present, okay, under the law on statute. Let's try to identify it, right? Because the key is not to understanding the statute. The key is to understand how the facts satisfy the statute. Question 10. God bless. Rambo, California citizen, loves Eastwood, also California, while in the airport in Baltimore. Could Eastwood or plaintiff, could Eastwood sue Rambo in Maryland? Which one?
Maybe.
It's C. Right? Yes, Rambo has committed a tortious act in Maryland. Right? Tortious injury in the state by an act or omission in the state. Yes, Rambo has committed a tortious act in Maryland. In parens, 4C. 5C, rather. Does the claim arise out of that activity? Sure. So that's why it's specific jurisdiction. Could he sue him for anything? Could Rambo sue, could he sue Rambo for anything in Maryland? No. And as long as it has to be related to the activity that he's relying on. Question 11. Dupas Manufacturing makes valves in Ohio. It sells them to a heater manufacturer in Pennsylvania, which incorporates the valves into its heaters and sells them in turn nationwide. So Dupas makes the valves in Ohio, sells them to somebody in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania puts them in its heaters and sells them nationwide. So the Dupas valve in one of these heaters malfunctions in Maryland, injuring Anita. May she sue Dupas in Maryland? Well, where is the tort committed? The tort was committed outside of the state, right? And caused injury in the state. Because where the negligent act was done is where the tort was committed, not where the injury was. Okay, so this is the answer. This is a tort committed out of state causing an injury in Maryland. This is a tort committed out of state causing an injury in Maryland. So what's the answer? Can she sue in that? Well, Anita may sue in Maryland. Only if, you know the answer, only if D satisfies one of the plus factors. Only if D satisfies one of the plus factors. What are they? Either regular does business or does a lot of substantial revenue. Put in parens so you know. 5D. These numbers do not correspond to the sections of the law. This outline. Question 12. Chad, citizen of Georgia, contracts with Catherine Harris, also a citizen of Georgia, to renovate Harris's summer home in Maryland. Chad refuses to perform. Catherine may sue Chad in Maryland. Why? Is it 4E? Real property? No.
B.
B. Yes. Chad is contracted to supply services in Maryland. B. 5D. Okay, we're going to go back to question. Question 13 is just a reprint of question 7. When we looked at these facts last time, we concluded there was no general jurisdiction over this corporation because it was neither incorporated nor had its principal place of business in Maryland. Let's look at it again, though, from the point of view of the Longarm statute. Butler's Biscuits, a Delaware corporation with its principal place of business in Georgia, has offices in Maryland and engages in substantial interstate and interstate commerce business here. It is sued in Maryland on a breach of contract claim unrelated to Maryland. Butler's is not subject to personal jurisdiction under Maryland's Longarm statute. Why? Well, what one do you think it is?
You're thinking to yourself, well, it looks like the plus factor, right? You're thinking about the statement.
Circle the third line from the bottom. Breach of contract claim. Breach of contract claim. See it in the facts? So how does that change your answer?
Well, the one you were looking at, 4D,
is for torts, not for breach of contract. So it's not 4D, okay? Because this is a contract claim, not a tort claim. 5D, I keep saying that wrong because I changed my mind. Not 5D, because this is a contract claim, not a tort claim. But what about 5B? We're talking about contract. Well, it's not 5B. Why isn't it 5B? Contracts to supply goods, services, etc. in Maryland. Well, it's not 5B because the contract has no connection to Maryland, right? It's a breach of contract claim unrelated to Maryland. It's not 5B because the contract has no connection to Maryland. Let's do two more. Tyson's Chicken, incorporated with its principal place of business in Arkansas, maintains chicken processing plants along the East Coast, including a large plant on Maryland's eastern shore. A worker at the Maryland plant sues Tyson's, alleging unsafe working conditions caused her injury. Is there jurisdiction over D for this claim under the Maryland Longarm statute? I want you to look. There are possibly three bases. I want you to try to identify what they are. That one may be right, but it contracts to supply goods, first service, or manufactured products in Maryland. That's iffy to me because we don't know whether the actual claim arises out of those contracts or not. So I'd say it's possible on that. A better bet would be 5C, right? Causes costs of injury in the state by an interstate act. And also 5E, because it owns real property in Maryland. Let's go through the ones that are sure bets. 5A. Transacting business in Maryland. 5C, causing tortious injury in the state by an interstate act. 5E, owning real property in Maryland. Note to yourself, write this down. Note that P's claim must relate to the activity. And it does so for all three bases. Let's look at the question one more time. Just change the facts a little bit. Let me repeat that last time. Note that peace claim must relate to the activity, and it does so for all three bases. Question 15. What if a North Carolina worker brings a claim in a Maryland court against Tyson's for an injury in the North Carolina plant? which works there. A lot of all the ones we talked about don't seem to work because the things, the Maryland basis in there that afforded us jurisdiction in 14 don't apply here because it took place in Carolina. Do we have anyone?
Should
I D? 4D, yes. Yes, under 4D. Why? Okay, causing tortious injury in the state by an out-of-state act. Causing tortious injury under 5D, causing tortious injury in the state by an out-of-state act. And having the plant in Maryland satisfies the plus factor, right? We need that plus factor to satisfy that. Having the plant in Maryland satisfies the plus factor. Because if it has a plant in Maryland, it regularly does business in Maryland. That's how I would do it. Okay, so the question is, can we serve this particular defendant, the facts tell you. They tell you all about where he lives, where he was going, where he was when he served, what the activities were, etc. Do we have personal jurisdiction over him? Well, the first step is to figure out whether any of the statutory, whether consent or any of the four statutory bases that we talked about are met. Now we know how to do that. We sort of have a general idea how to do that. The second step is, well, even if it's okay, they sometimes ask you if it's constitutionally permissible. That's a separate inquiry, because even though it may be okay under the statute, it might be unconstitutional, it might not be fair.
Well, just to remind ourselves of what we talk about when we ask this question, whether something's constitutionally fair or not, we have a little bit of a little mnemonic they should remember. My parents frequently read funny children's stories. Okay. What's the whole thing about the due process? Whether it's fair, right? Whether it's fair to bring this defendant into the fore. Who cares what the statute says? Let's make sure that it's fair. Well, most of the statutes are designed to ensure that it is fair. But let's go through these different items that are signified by these letters here. My parents frequently read. Well, the first thing we look at, we know this, and we're trying to figure out whether there are whether it's constitutional or not, whether there are minimum contacts or not. Now, when a court is trying to figure out whether the defendant has sufficient contact with the state of Maryland to constitutionally justify the due process of bringing him into a Maryland court, they're going to ask themselves, hey, did this defendant purposely avail himself of the benefits of the parole? Part of that, a separate inquiry is often, but it's the same thing. Could our defendant have foreseen, okay, that he would have been brought into a Maryland court based on his actions, that he would be hailed into a Maryland court? Another thing we look at is relatedness, okay, between the claim and the form. They look at that in the minimum contacts analysis, right? So if our defendant is doing something in Maryland, he's purposely availing himself of the benefits of Maryland, and he could foresee being sued in Maryland for something, that often isn't good enough, right, unless what he's doing in Maryland is the basis of the plaintiff's claim. So we often are looking for a connection between the activity, right, between the purposeful availment and foreseeability, that those minimum contacts activities and plaintiff's claim. That's called relatedness. What's the exception to that? General jurisdiction. Because when we have general jurisdiction, we don't care whether there's relatedness or not, right? That's it's domicile or incorporated in the state or present, we don't care about it. Okay, but if it's a long arm statute situation, I can see for the plus factor. Remember the one we talked about? Defendant causes an out of state injury, okay, from an act out of state, then there's a plus factor. Well, if the activity is very, very minor, right, the activity connection between the activity in Maryland and that out of state action is very tenuous, even though it technically falls within that long-arm statute provision, the court might say it stinks, right? Because it doesn't meet the minimum contacts test.
You should know when you do a minimum contacts analysis, You remember from federal civil procedure, nobody agrees on anything, right? 15 million opinions in one case. You don't have to come up with the right answer, but you need to know, because there is no definitive right answer, but you need to know what to be looking at. So these are the things you have to look at for minimum context. Now, when it's iffy as to minimum context, we also go on to what they used to call the cold fairness analysis, right? So we are in the second part of our remark. Okay, fair play and substantial justice. That's what F stands for. What do we look at when we look at fair play and substantial justice? We look at the convenience. Okay, is this greatly, greatly, greatly inconvenient to our defendant? Right. That's our C. And also we look at the state's interest. Does Maryland have a real interest in having this case? That's when there is a toss-up on the minimum context analysis, courts often go into the fairness analysis, and they say it was less
important. What is the impact on the defendant here? Should it be greatly inconvenient to him?
What is Maryland's stake in this? Okay, we're dragging this guy into Maryland. What is Maryland's stake? Do we have an interest in it? But we may be interested in it if the plaintiff is a Maryland resident. We may have an interest in it if it involves a Maryland law. Okay? But if it's not a Maryland plaintiff and it's not a Maryland law, and the minimum context analysis is fuzzy, we're going to say, well, when we look at state's interest, that sort of tips it constitutionally not good.
See what I'm saying? Is that true? I mean, it's not something we can test and say, well, here's a hypothetical and this is how it's going to come out. But you just have to remember these are the key concepts that you need to think about and talk about if you're asked whether there's a constitutional problem with the assertion of personal jurisdiction.
One other thing I'm going to talk about, then, this is the last time we're going to leave constitutional stuff behind because it's a little bit hard to follow sometimes. Concept of quasi-in rem jurisdiction. Do you remember quasi-in rem a little bit? Quasi-in rem jurisdiction is when we have a situation where we can't get jurisdiction over our defendant. We go through all our bases, and I had with the attorney, but there's no way we can exercise jurisdiction over it. But we figure out that there's a way we can still jumpstart this lawsuit because there's some property, okay, of the defendant located in Maryland. When we decide to start our lawsuit because there's property of the defendant located in Maryland and we don't have any other ground, right, for it, we're really starting a lawsuit on the basis of quasi-in-rem jurisdiction. Get to this, we don't get to it today, unfortunately, we get to it in the full lecture. The way we start this lawsuit is not by serving a summons and complaint, but by, does anyone remember if there was Pannoia v. Neff? What do you have to do first? You gotta attach the property. Okay, you gotta get an order of attachment and attach the property. I'm not going to get into it too much because we develop it later in the second half of the lecture. You're not going to get it, but basically, quasi-in rem jurisdiction starts differently. You have to assert, you have to attach the property to begin with. The second thing you have to remember is that when you assert jurisdiction over the case by the quasi-in rem, your judgment, okay, is only as good as the value of that property, right? So if I have a painting that's worth $1 million, right, and I get a judgment for $500,000, I'm going to sell that painting, I'm going to be doing fine. But if I'm foolish enough to attach this pen, okay, at the beginning of the proceeding, what's going to happen is that once I get my $1 million judgment, I'll sell the pen, right, and I get 10 cents for it. What happens to the rest of the judgment? Well, if it's a quasi-in rem, judgment rendered in a quasi-rem action, that judgment disappears. It's gone. No good whatsoever. What would happen, in contrast, if it was a judgment in an action we had real personal jurisdiction over the person? What would you do? Well, you have the pen, okay? Then you go up there's other property. Then you can go to another state and say, listen, New York, I have a judgment, okay, that I got in Maryland. You have to give me full faith and credit on it. You could start an enforcement proceeding there. So quasi-rem is no, is of limited use. Okay, because it's only as good as the property that's attached. The third thing you have to remember about quasi-in-rem jurisdiction is that it's still, since a case called Shepard v. Hyde, which you don't have to worry about, it's still subject to those constitutional standards. We still have to worry about whether it's fair, okay? And there's a lot of talk about what makes it fair or not, but really the basic inquiry in deciding whether it's fair is whether the item of property that I'm attaching related to my claim. This really seems to be the basic inquiry. So that, keep it in the back of your mind when you take the full course. We'll go into it in more detail, but that's what quasi-inherent jurisdiction is about.
I guess we're tired. We want to take a 10-minute break? Or fine, let's take a 10-minute break, because it's a lot to... it's 4 after. Let's reassemble at 4 after. Anybody have any questions or want me to just repeat something, just come on up, okay, because I'm happy to do so. Nostalgically about the MPT lecture, right? Well, it wasn't so bad after the silk procedure.
Is the procedure on the MPT?
It's only because...
You can sign those on the multi...
big bar, I
think. Well, no, multi-choice one.
Well, that's a procedure.
It is.
Yes.
Because it wasn't listed on the sheet. It wasn't listed on Penpedal.
Well, I would double check it, but last time I checked it was.
That's what I thought, and it wasn't listed on the website. So that was the time you're
interested. I only buy when it comes
to any questions? No questions?
Right now. actually matters, or can I just continue to not listen to you?
You can continue.
Yeah, it's really because this thing, I mean, I need a new one anyway, but it's just so heavy.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's really weird.
Yeah.
Is that like 6 or 7 pounds?
Probably. I don't know exactly, but yeah.
Ew.
Yep.
If I were you,
I
would go to the gym. That's working out.
No. Because I have a bad back anyway. I don't need it. Like, and I just need a new one. It's been like.
Okay.
I found one. Hold on, there you go.
I better graduate.
So wait, is it a notebook or iPad notebook?
It's the SAS.
Oh.
No, I'm sorry. It's a episode. They show up in case.
Oh my.
I got a campus.
Oh my.
But they may have
one.
It's convenient.
I like it a lot. I mean, I love the winter. No,
that's good.
Oh,
Jesus.
It's a large capacity.
Yeah, that's what I have.
Has this program help check helpful?
I got the warranty.
I think it takes some getting used to sort of the almost dictation-like aspect of it all. That I think too, it sort of prepped me for what to expect later in the summer. So in that aspect, it's good. And too, I think there are certain things you can't hear enough.
I know.
You know, and so better now to have this primer to like swing in on June 2nd or July 1st and hear about virtual jurisdiction or whatever again. Well, it's sort of, it's been sort of beat into you, you know, that it's, and it's true that it's a marathon and not a sprint, and so right. Just actually putting the time in already, I think, gets you ready for, or not gets you ready, but sort of gives you an idea of what you're doing, what you're doing later.
Yeah.
I haven't actually
had
this before. I'm
going to
try.
Not go to that wedding.
There is.
When my brother got engaged a year ago, I read for him. I'm like, you're not. Because it was a year ago. So they got married in October.
Go try.
They got married in, you know, 9 months instead of a year and a half.
Yeah. Well, my friend is in Korea and she's getting married. And it won't matter that we're not.
Yeah.
And I was like, what are you doing?
But it's more power A, more power B. You know, but
I'm
not any of it.
Yeah, I'm gonna go backpacking.
For 2 weeks. But I have
one here.
I was supposed to do. I meant to just sort of do it after college, but I actually started working right away, and so. I'll do mostly youth hostels, but there are places that my father used to stay, but now that he's alive, he used to always say, someday you know, I'll go here. So,
it's pushing
you. Yeah, well, but part of it is to, I just before he died, we decided that we all sort of got together and decided we would spread his ashes to those 5 favorite places in the world. And so, yeah, so I will do Sardinia, and my brother will do Auckland, and my mother will do, you know, so.
I actually did on the end of
travel. Yeah, he did. He did environmental and regulatory affairs. the company started out really small, but over the years they grew, and so when they would want to buy a place, you know, they send them and they'd say, look, we'll buy you, but you, you know, you're worth this much in liabilities, so this is how we'll fix it.
I'm a very risk.
And now that's what I do too. I do an all the regulatory law. So it's nice to realize this for everybody.
My boyfriend has
that.
Yeah.
That's what my bar trip is. I know people go on cruises or, you know, really.
And under, it's going to be a district court case, right?
If it's over $30,000, it's going to be a circuit court case. That's a general rule. It's not all cases. That's generally how I think about it. In between, okay, if it's greater than 5, okay, but equal or less than 30, it's concurrent jurisdiction. You can go to either or. So the plaintiff figures out which court he wants to go. Well, that's fine, okay, in terms of figuring out the amounts. One thing we need to figure out before we actually talk about the actual types of lawsuits and the actual figures is how do we come up with the dollar amount that's at issue for the particular claim. I'm a plaintiff, right, and I want to sue a particular defendant. I may have more than one claim against that defendant. Does each claim that I have against the defendant need to meet that be over $5,000 in order to get to circuit court, or can I combine it together? And what if I have a claim against two defendants? Can I combine those? So those are the things we're going to talk about right now. Those are the rules, they're called aggregation rules. What we can add together for purposes of determining whether we meet that threshold amount needed to get into a circuit court. Aggregation rules for multiple defendants. In determining an amount of controversy, a single plaintiff may aggregate claims made against the same defendant. Okay, so if I'm suing you and I have like different claims against you, that's fine. I can add them up. If they're over 5, I can choose circuit court. I may not aggregate claims against multiple defendants. So if I sue two of you, I have to make sure that each claim against you is over the requisite amount. That's the exception for that, is if I'm suing both of you as joint, I hope you don't mind that I keep suing both of you here. So I'm suing both as joint owners of property, or as joint tortfeasors. In that case, your liability is really one and the same, right? You're going to be jointly and severally liable. So that's an exception. So if I'm suing two tortfeasors and they're jointly and severally liable, I'm going to be suing to one amount. I can add that amount together. That's simple back on the basis of that's the figure I would use to determine the court. Okay, now let's think about multiple plaintiffs. So that's the situation. Just figure it out. If I'm suing you, I can add it up. If I'm suing two, I can't add it up unless they join court fees. What about you and I? Why don't we go into court together? Why don't we join up, Joe Smith, as plaintiffs, and we'll sue this one defendant here? Can we add our claims up? The answer is no. Multiple plaintiffs may not aggregate claims against a single defendant. Okay? Unless they're seeking to enforce a single right or judgment in which they have a common or divided interest. That means we're both owners of property, right? We're both owners of property. We're both the beneficiaries under a contract. So we have a common and undivided right. We can add it up. But for the most part, two plaintiffs, they're not going to add up their damages against a single defendant in order to figure out whether they're in circuit court or not. So if I'm a plaintiff and I have a claim against you for $3,000, and another plaintiff has a claim against you for $3,000, I can't say let's get together and aggregate. It doesn't work that way. Okay. Another type of thing we think about when we're trying to figure out whether this concurrent or whether it's jurisdiction in circuit court or district court is the type of lawsuit. Because there's some lawsuits that regardless of the amount of controversy, they're going to be in one court or the other. Okay? For district court, okay, these actions remain in district court regardless of the amount of controversy. For plebid actions, okay, the object of the action is to recover property that you say belongs to you. And most landlord and tenant actions for possession of the premises. Okay. Well, if a jury trial demanded, it gets slipped into circuit court. Those two actions are going to be in district court for the most part. Exclusive jurisdiction over circuit court for these actions. Okay. Most equity actions. Okay. What's an equity action? An action where you're not trying to get damages, but you're trying to have the court tell the defendant to do something or not do something. District courts don't have equitable powers, except in very limited circumstances, except that they're exercising in a reclaimant action or a landlord-tenant action for possession of property. Okay. An action for declaratory judgment is the same idea. Okay. An action to decide who owns real property, which is different from trying to regain possession. Who owns this property? That goes to circuit court. Most domestic relations cases. So those, do you have to memorize it? No. But you know when you get the provision, when you get the extract that's split up the jurisdiction, subject matter jurisdiction of the courts, you have that sort of the framework of it in mind. There's exclusive jurisdiction for certain types of actions, some in district court, some in circuit court. There's also but the other, we're going to look at the monitor and ask, and we're going to keep the aggregation rules in mind. Okay, so far so good? Okay, so let's look at the chart here that I've made up here, which is sort of mind-boggling. I think it's better than not having a chart, right? So let's, first thing with our chart is let's draw a line right through the, going sideways. Right, see where the box that says reflected actions, and then above it, there's a line that says proceedings for various civil penalties. Draw a line right all across that page there, okay? Now above that, why did I draw a line there? Right in the middle of the page. Right across here. Why is there a line? Yeah. Everything above is relates to the money, the amount of controversy. Everything below relates to the type of action. If we look at the above, we'll see that for the most part, what I said about the 5 and 5 to 30 and 30, that works. Okay, there's some exceptions. Okay, you don't have to know what those exceptions are or commit them to memory, but just know that for some, the range is 5 or less and above 5 to 20. That's for actions for money seized by government, for gambling offenses, proceedings for civil penalties. So it's not always up to 30. Okay. Action for a dishonored check. If I'm suing on a dishonored check, no matter how much it's worth, I can always go to district court. Why is that? Probably because it's easy to prove that someone fails to pay on a dishonored check, so district court can handle it. If the defendant is above $25,000 and the defense says, hey, I want to be in circuit court, he can demand to be brought into circuit court and there'll be a case of a transfer obligation. Look at this, the actions below the line, okay? You have those things that we talked about with the district court, reflected actions, okay? Injunctions and reflected actions. Actions to recover possession, proceedings for peace order. Share, okay? Are ones in this box here, exclusively in circuit court. Any equity action that's supported above, any action to decide ownership of real property, and action for declaratory judgment. Do you understand the chart? Not that you have now, you memorize the chart, but you sort of understand what the chart is. And you understand the aggregation rules? So let's test ourselves to see if we know what we're doing. Okay, so we're doing, it's funny, when you get these Maryland essays, okay, they're just so basic, okay? They want you to know where to bring the court, what court is the proper court. They require a lot of this basic stuff that you would think is almost like silly to have to go through, but they want you to do it. Okay, let's look at some of the questions. To which court should these cases go? Question 16. Latter landlord sues 10 to 10 for repossession of the premises and for $35,000 in back rent. What court or courts? Look at the chart. It's a hybrid action. And it's a hybrid action. The action to recover possession goes to district court. Incorrect, they have exclusive jurisdiction, right? Right? For an action to recover possession is district court. The action for back rent is a contract action in excess of $30,000. So it goes to circuit court. So you guys can't bring one court, okay? The action to recover possession of the premises needs to be a district court because district court has exclusive jurisdiction. The action for back rent is a contract action in excess of $30,000. So that goes to circuit court. Where is that on our chart? If we look on our chart on the prior page, row down for contract actions above 30,000. That's why it's exclusively a circuit court. If we go all the way down the rows here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, we see actions to recover possession, right underneath that long line A, so to draw actions to recover possession, goes to district court regardless of the amount of controversy. So that's why that answer came out the way it did. Let's look at question 17. He sues D for an injunction related to a breach of contract. The value is $12,000. Okay, the value of the claim is $12,000. wants to perform this contract. What happens? Goes to circuit court. Why does it go to circuit court? I said it was a 12th basket. You say, well, don't leave that to circuit court. You have to go to circuit court. The district court has no equity powers. Goes to circuit court, period. District court has no equity powers except as listed in charter. Question 18. Sam purchases property from Mel for $500,000. Mel delivers a deed, but Sam refuses to leave. Where does it go? Which court has subject matter jurisdiction on it? Oh, one. The other. It's an action to recover possession. Where does it go?
District
court. Curley, question 19. Curley sues Mo for $4,000 in damages for personal injuries and $3,000 in damages for property damages, both arising from the same wrong work, same accident. He brings the suit in circuit court. Is that okay? You got $4,000 and $3,000, he's joining up. Is that okay? Under our aggregation rules? Yeah, it's okay, right? Because I can combine my claims. Yes, C can aggregate claims against the same defendant. Question 20. What if Curley's two claims are unrelated? You said they say rise from the same accident. What if they're totally unrelated? Still okay. C can aggregate his claims against the same defendant, comma, even if they are unrelated. C can aggregate his claims against the same defendant, even if they are unrelated. So who's going after Valentine's Day? Anyone got plans? No? My wife found out that Waterford is going out of business, so she says, I just want to buy Waterford. Now, I don't know, so I said, yeah, go ahead. How much is that going to cost me? So I told her, well, Costco's selling Waterford. She says, that's not the Waterford I want. I said, okay, I'll lecture again. How small the are.
But I'm going to go to a restaurant, I think. For our Valentine's Day. I'm writing at my wife's Valentine's Day card. I'm doing this because, not because I know you think you're interested in my personal life, but you're looking glassy-eyed. writing my Valentine's Day card to my wife, right, because she's insists I do it. It's the 30th Valentine's Day card I've written. Isn't that scary?
So, our first Valentine's Day, we had a fight. That's the neighbor card, anyway.
And it involved our future mother-in-law. See, these three things never change. Okay.
If you were to sue your future mother-in-law.
Our future what?
If you were to sue your future mother-in-law.
Yeah, we'll put that in a hypo. Put in a hypo.
Okay, let's go to question 21. Everyone awake? Okay, next break we'll talk about movies. Okay, if you have anything that interests you in particular, right, we can talk about it. Sex, drugs, rock and roll, just go through them in the beginning. 21. Fred sues Ricky for negligence, alleging damages of $5,000. That's easy, right? It's a negligence act. Where does it go? District court. Easy, goes to district court. Can Ricky counterclaim for damages of $35,000? We don't know the answer to that. I'll give it to you. No. The counterclaim is in the exclusive jurisdiction of circuit court. So Ricky should file a circuit court and request the stay of the district court proceeding. No, counterclaim is in the exclusive jurisdiction of circuit court. Ricky should file in circuit court and request a stay of the district court proceeding. Make a note for yourself in the chart, okay? And if he wants to, Fred can probably remove to circuit court if his claim is related to Ricky's counterclaim.
If he wants to, Fred can remove the circuit court if his claim is related to where he's counseling. So everything is sort of like supplemental jurisdiction. See what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Let me say it again. This is how it starts. This is how it starts.
Fred sues Ricky for a very small itsy-bitsy claim for $5,000. So he's in district court. Ricky says, I have a claim for $35,000. Can he insert it in the district court action? No, we can't. So he's got to go to circuit court and start his lawsuit. He's going to tell the circuit court there's another action in district court that's about the same argument that we're having, the same claim. So the circuit court's going to say, you can start your action here. I'll stay that district court action for now. But we want to get the big action organized rather than have the little bitty district court resolve matters. Okay? So now there's a lawsuit in circuit court by Ricky handling his $35,000 counterclaim. Fred's $5,000 claim is frozen in state. Fred, if he wants to, can go to circuit court and say, hey, listen, I'm hanging out here in district court with my stinking $5,000 claim, but since you already have a big claim, a $35,000 claim that's related to the same matter, would you mind, circuit court, removing, taking that claim from the jurisdiction of the district court and putting it in this circuit court action? And the circuit court action, and the circuit court will say, sure,
I have the authority to do that.
Okay, so that's how that would work.
Okay, if it's a medical malpractice lawsuit, there's a few things they might ask you. What happens if there's a medical malpractice lawsuit? So we could figure out what court you're going to bring it in based on our typical rules, our 530 rules. But there are things that have to happen beforehand. So let's just go through the things we need to think about for our medical malpractice claims. A medical malpractice claim is against anybody who's delivering healthcare provider, a doctor, a nurse, hospital, a college, social worker, etc. Okay. What happens is if I want to start a lawsuit against a doctor or any other healthcare provider based on medical malpractice, I as plaintiff have to start the ball rolling by getting a certificate from a medical expert attesting to these departments and standards of care. Basically, I have to get somebody to come up with a plate to say that the deed is something wrong. You don't have to do that for lack of informed consent, because the idea of lack of informed consent is not that there was a departure from standard of care, it was just that he didn't tell you the risks. But for all of the cases, the plaintiff has to get that certificate. Okay. Now, D thinks he's going to contest liability. He's not just going to roll over and say, yeah, take my money. He's got to go get a certificate from his health care professional, right, that basically says that he did comply with the standard of care. Okay, after the filing of the certificates, they're ready to go to arbitration. But either party may say, forget arbitration. Because as we're going to see later, this arbitration really isn't going to resolve the lawsuit in most cases. If they don't agree to waive arbitration, then they're going to go to arbitration. And the arbitrator will come out one way or the other and decide what the amount is owed. Now, if the parties both agree that that's a fair result, that's the end of it. But if either one can test liability, then they just go to court anyway. And the arbitration award becomes a rebuttable presumption, okay, of liability. So it's something that the other side has to overcome. The other side has the burden of proof. So that's what we need to think about before we go to court if we have a healthcare, an action against the healthcare provider. We have to make sure we get our certificates, okay, from either side. We have to figure out whether we waive arbitration or not. If we go to arbitration, we don't accept it. Then we move into the main lawsuit, and if we're the loser in the arbitration proceeding below, we just have that rebuttable presumption. You can't go to court, you can't go to the circuit court and say, boy, that arbitrator was an idiot, okay? He didn't know what he was doing, he misconstrued the law. I don't want to have a rebuttable presumption against me. Whatever the arbitrator says goes, okay? Unless there's fraud. That's how it is generally for arbitration, right? The arbitrator is given pretty much a lot of leeway in determining the merits of the lawsuit. Okay, that's the special rules for medical malpractice claims that I just want to talk to you a bit about. There's also one other thing I want to talk to you about, jury trials and transfer. If you're in Maryland, okay, Maryland Constitution says that you get a jury trial for any case where the amount of controversy exceeds 10,000. That's not equitable claims, okay? That's for claims that don't involve the equitable power control, right? So we're looking at damages claims, right? Jury trials are available only in circuit courts, not district courts. So this is how it happens. Okay, question 23 gives the start. P sues her employer for a year's worth of unpaid house cleaning services. She files her claim for $11,000 in the district court for Bethesda. D demands a jury trial. What happens? Well, because the district court has no juries, right? The action is removed to suit. Because district courts have no juries, the action is removed to a lawsuit. How do you figure out what's happening when you want to remove the case? The clerk notifies the parties of the date. The case is adopted in the circuit court after it's transferred over, and they basically start again. The defendant has to respond to the complaint within 30 days. Okay, so if the amount of controversy is enough in circuit court jurisdiction and you're the defendant and you want to be in circuit court, you just demand a jury. And then there you go. Okay, can you transfer from the circuit court to the district court? Hey, we were invited here by mistake. You shouldn't be there. Yes, if all the parties agree, it can be transferred back. If not, the lawsuit needs to be dismissed and the parties got to settle. Now, we're going to do the easiest thing in the world. So even though you want me to stop, I'm not going to stop because it's so easy, you don't even have to listen to me. Well, you're going to go down to 80% of attention span. So we're going to talk about venue. Okay? What's venue? Right. Someone says, you want to eat Burger King or McDonald's? And they say, Burger King, okay? Then the next question is, which Burger King, right? Burger King or McDonald's is subject matter jurisdiction question, right? Which Burger King is venue? Okay? Don't say that exactly on the essay, but that's the idea behind it. Now, when you're trying to figure out which circuit court to go to, okay, or which district court to go to, you're not looking for one court. You're looking for a choice of courts. Okay, you might say to yourself, hey, the venue rules say I can bring it in this county, or that county. So I'm the plaintiff, I have the master of my lawsuit, I'm going to choose this particular county. So when you're looking for venue choices, just as when you're looking through that long arm statute, you don't find one and stop, right? You just keep going.
So let's look at our venue rules, which are pretty straightforward.
Well, they're tested, right? So we might as well know what they are. Okay, so basic concept. I already told you what the basic concept is about. Timing. Okay, the defendant waives any objection to a proper venue if he does not assert his defense by preliminary motion. We'll talk about that. Personal jurisdiction, venue. These are things that the defendant should, if he wants to complain about, he better do it soon. It's not like subject matter jurisdiction, which is really the court's problem, right? If venue's improper, what can the court do? The court can say, get out of here, to dismiss the action, or just can transfer to the right court. Why can it do that? Well, because circuit court is one court. That doesn't mean that he can transfer it over from one branch to the other. Now, when we're trying to figure out, okay, how to acquire a venue, the first thing we have to ask ourselves, thank you very much, have a good weekend. The first thing we have to think about is whether it's a local action or a transitory action, okay? If we take all the actions in the world, local action is about this much, and transitory action is about that much. So it's really, we're almost always going to end up figuring out it's a transitory action. And that's where our real venue rules are going to come into effect. But our preliminary thing, we're going to ask if it's a local action. A local action is a very particular type of real estate action. It's a case for a petition of real estate, or a mortgage foreclosure case, or trespass to land, or waste to real property. All of those are local actions. If it's none of those, it's not a local action. If it is one of those, it must be brought in the county where the property is. That's where venue's problem. Okay? It's probably most likely going to be a transitory action, which means anything that's not a local action, anything that's not one of those four real estate actions I talked about. Okay? Any action that is a transitory action, identify proper venues as follows. This is what you look to. Step one, okay, you look at the venues arising from the location of the defense. There are two ways to figure out a venue. One is from the location of the defendants, and the other one is additional venues based on the type of lawsuit. So we're always going to think about two different things. Who are our defendants? Okay, and then we're also going to think about who are our, what type of lawsuit do we have? Okay, if we're suing an individual defendant, where can we sue him? Can we sue him in any county? No, we can sue that individual in the county or counties where an individual defendant resides, carries on a regular business, is employed, or habitually engages in a vocation. Okay, one of those things. Corporate defendant. The county where the corporate defendant maintains its principal in state offices or carries on a regular business. That's going to present us with different choices, right? A non-resident individual defendant, any county in Maryland. We don't have it. Okay? We can bring our lawsuit in any county in Maryland. Does that mean we don't have to get personal jurisdiction over him? No, we have to. That's a separate thing, right? We have to figure out whether we get personal jurisdiction over this guy who's not in Maryland. Maybe we caught him passing through.
Maybe he did something under the long arm statute out of the state, right? But when we're figuring out venue rules and he's not in the state of Maryland, well, we're going to say, well, he's an individual. He's residing outside of the state of Maryland. I'm the plaintiff. I can pick any county in Maryland.
Now, if it's a out-of-state corporate defendant, you think it would be the same thing. No, you have to pick it in the county where you reside, where you appoint. A different rule doesn't seem to make sense to distinguish between those two situations, but they do. Well, that's fine, but what if there's more than one defendant? Then what do you do? Well, if there are multiple defendants, you sue in a county where that is proper for all the defendants. Okay, so you look at, I can sue this particular defendant in these three counties, I can sue this particular defendant in these counties, you know, based on where they live or reside or live or carry on a business, et cetera. And then I look at my list and I say, well, is there any county that's common to all of them, right? If there's one in each, there's one the same county in each person's list, then that's the county I pick. What if there's no common venue? What if there's not the same county in everybody's list? Well, if there's no common venue, then venue is good in one of the following counties. If and only if, you should underline, if and only if there's no common venue, right? You don't go to this second step here, this second part of the multiple defendants inquiry, unless there's no common county. If there's no common venue, then you can sue them in any county in which any one of the defendants can be sued. I can't find a common county, I'm going to figure out, I'm going to sue one of the counties where the defendants can be sued. Or else I can do where the cause of action arose. Okay. So what's the purpose of venue? The purpose of venue is I'm the plaintiff, I'm bringing the lawsuit where I want to. We want to make sure that we're not greatly inconveniencing our defendants. So venue rules are sort of trying to steer us to the right county so that give us a choice, but to limit our choice to counties that are going to be not too inconvenient to our defendants. We also have another source of venue rules to look at. Okay, what type of action it is. Okay, now there are only four actions we have to think of. Negligence actions, replevin actions, divorce or annulment actions, custody actions. Okay, a negligence action, in addition to the counties that we get on our list when we go through this exercise in the first part, we're going to look at where the cause of action arose, where the injury occurred. Right? It's a replevin action. Okay. If it's an interest involving an interest of land or property, replevin, the county where at least part of it is located. Notice that replevin, okay, is not one of our local actions. That's why it's down here. Divorce or annulment. In divorce, where the plaintiff resides. In annulment, right, that is decided where the plaintiff resides or where the marriage took place. Custody, related to child custody or support for the father, mother, or child resides. Now, I know you've been paying attention, right? Nobody's been going on their phone to check the message. Actually, my daughter was in a play, so she sang a song. So we put it on YouTube so all the family could see. But my wife thinks that every child molester in the world is like just waiting for my daughter's video to come, so we have to take it down.
See you later. Unless you have special affection for children, and I can't do this.
Question 24. Where does any property Park sues George, Dan, and Crisco on a breach of contract payable in Calvert County? See, you thought you didn't have the list to me, but you had to because you have a question. What do we ask ourselves? Any common venue?
PG.
Prince George's County. So yeah, that's good. Any additional venues? No. Why not? It's a breach of contract action. It's not a negligence action, a replevin action, divorce annulment action, it's not a custody case. Okay, question 24 again. Any common general venue? Yes, Prince George's County. So that's the one. We don't go on to that other rules for multiple defendants. Remember, so if it's, you can sue in any county, you don't do that because we got a common county here. Any additional venues under our second step where we look at the type of action? No, it doesn't fall into one of those four. It's not negligence or replevin, divorce annulment or a custody case. What if Prince Company's principal office moves out of Prince George's, right, to Montgomery County? Now what do we do? Well, step one, there's no common county, right? Any common general venue? No common county, comma. So a venue is okay where any defendant resides or works, right? Which is Prince George's, PG, Montgomery, or Anne Arundel. No common county, so a venue is okay where any defendant resides or works. Prince George's, Montgomery, Anne Arundel. I didn't finish the answer though. What did I forget to tell you today? It was one of the managers.
You're so tired. Why are you so tired? This is the most interesting thing you're going to do today, man. Right?
What other county?
Baltimore City.
What?
Baltimore City. Oh, no, Calvert County.
Calvert County, what?
Because of the contract breach arose there, and that's under the if and only if.
Where it's under the if and only if. There's no common county. We get any county where a defendant is and where the cause of action arose. So the second, you have to answer with this, or the county where the claim arose, which is Calvert County.
So for step one, there's no common county, so a venue is okay where any defendant resides or works. Prince George's, Montgomery, Anne Arundel, with the county where the claim arose, which is Calvert County. The breach of contract, it was payable in Calvert, that's where it arose. Any additional venues? No, because the type of lawsuit didn't change. There's still no additional venues for the same reason as in question 24. Still no additional venues for the same reason. Question 24. Question 26. When a court brings a suit to Baltimore City and the defendants make a preliminary motion, because they're going to find out that's what they have to do, they make a motion to dismiss for improper venue. Well, it is. It's improper venue. Let's face it. It's not on our list. The court will either dismiss the action. Or transfer it to a county where venue is proper. Okay. Transfer of venue. Court may order a change of venue under these circumstances. This is a little bit of a real repetition here. Improper venue. If a timely preliminary motion is made, right, the court may order the case transferred to the proper county rather than dismiss. Inconvenient venue. Even if you got the right one, even if this county was on your list of permissible venue choices, you could still come in as defendant, even if it was on plaintiff's list of permissible venue choices, the defendant can still say this is inconvenient to me. Okay? The court may, on a party's motion, transfer a case to a preferred venue. Okay? Transfer is allowed even if the original venue was proper, it would be of substantial justice. Okay? That might be great inconvenience to the defendant. Let's look at 27. Howard and his neighbor, who are both residents of Howard County. Howard lives and his neighbor both live in Howard County. They go to an Orioles game, which is in Baltimore. Howard hit a post when parking at Camden Yards in Baltimore. His neighbor, okay, the guy who's with Howard, brings a negligence action against him in Howard County, seeking to recover for whiplash and emotional distress at missing the game. If Howard moves to transfer to Baltimore City, should the court grant the motion? Well, let's think about it. Howard, so our defendant isn't Howard. So Howard is a good place. Is Baltimore a proper venue? Well, it's a negligence action, right? And that's where it is. So that's Baltimore's a proper venue. So we got two proper venues. So plaintiff could have figured out to bring it in Howard if he wanted, or Baltimore, and he chose Howard. How's the court going to rule? I think they're going to tell Howard from Howard that he's stuck in Howard, right? So I say, how should the court rule? I say no. Howard County is proper. Because Howard lives there, right? Howard County is proper because Howard lives there. Baltimore is also okay because it's a negligence action and the claim arose there.
Baltimore is also okay
because it's a negligence action and the claim arose there. However, what am I going to say? However, H is unlikely to convince the court that Howard County is an inconvenient venue. He lives there. However, H is unlikely to convince the court that Howard County is an inconvenient venue. Two more things and then we'll take a break. If a party can get another ground for our defendant saying he needs a transfer of venue, it's not that it's inconvenient, it's unfair. He's not going to be able to get a fair deal. Okay? A party cannot receive a fair and impartial trial because of pretrial publicity. He can move to remove. Okay? If the court finds reasonable grounds, it will order removal to a county it selects. It's different from the other one because if it's inconvenient, it has to be a proper venue. The court could just say, maybe this is the only proper place, but it's unfair, I'm moving it out. Minor thing, if you're not going to get, I don't think form inconvenience is going to come up. Just as we talked about quasi in rem to distinguish it from personal jurisdiction, I want to distinguish form nonconvenience from personal jurisdiction. Form nonconvenience, remember we talked about venue being this Burger King or that Burger King? Form nonconvenience is transferring from Burger King to McDonald's. You can't do that, right? You can't say go to Burger King to McDonald's. Circuit court can't, Maryland court can't transfer a case out of Maryland because it has no power over that other court out of Maryland to take the case, right? So form nonconvenience, if you hear about form nonconvenience, it's different from transfer of venue because venue is a transfer within a court system. Venue is transfer within a court system, one circuit court system, one district court system. Form nonconvenience is basically saying that this court system isn't good for one reason or another. We're not going to get into it. But that's the difference between a transfer of venue and form nonconvenience. Often the same considerations come into play when a court is deciding whether to transfer from one court to another or whether just to kick it out of Maryland altogether. But they are two distinct concepts. Let's take a 7-minute break. We need to finish up here. And I will see you in 3 or 4 minutes after 4. Yeah. Okay, we figured out personal jurisdiction. We figured out subject matter jurisdiction. We figured out venue. Does everybody have a grasp of what these things are about? Okay, our next thing is to figure out how to serve process. Process is what? Process is the thing we serve at the beginning of the lawsuit. Usually it means
the summons and complaint, right? The summons is issued by the clerk of the court. It basically tells the defendant he must appear in court and respond to the complaint. The complaint is drafted by the plaintiff's attorney, right?
So what happens? Plaintiff files a complaint with the court. Clerk issues the summons, has to be served with the complaint. The plaintiff has 60 days to take that summons and serve it. If not, it becomes dormant, right? You can't use it anymore. Then you have to go back to the court and renew it. Okay, that's the problem. One problem you might have with process is that it has become dormant. So look at the date that the summons was issued. The other thing you have to remember is who can serve process? Okay, anybody, okay? It could be the sheriff or any adult 18 years or over who is not a party to the case. So question 28, Larry Lloyd serves process for his client, Pat Plaintiff, on the defendant. Can he do so? Yes. Larry is not a party, and presumably over 18, unless he's some, you know, Doogie Howser type of kid, right? Larry is not a party and is presumably over 18. How do you serve somebody? You serve them a few ways. The most direct method is I take the summons and complaint and I hand it to the defendant. Okay? That's personal service. If it's an individual, I can go to his house. Okay? I can go to his usual place of abode and I can look for someone of suitable age and discretion who lives there and I can hand it to that person. Okay? No suitable age and discretion does not mean 18. You can be younger than 18 and be a suitable age and discretion. Question 29. Process is left with Dee's butler at Dee's summer home. Okay? Depends on 3 things. What are they?
Okay.
Right, is it summer? Right, depends on what. Is this home currently Dee's usual place of abode? One, is this home currently Dee's usual place of abode? Two, is the butler of suitable age and discretion? I would imagine, I would hope so. Baby butler. Is the butler of suitable age and discretion? Three, does the butler reside there? Okay, how to serve someone? Serve it on the defendant, serve it on someone at the guy's house who lives there as a suitable age of discretion. Another way, just send it to the person by certified mail. Easy enough. Put it in an envelope, certified mail, get the return receipt back. Out-of-state methods. Okay, service on the defendant outside of Maryland may also be made in the manner approved by the court. How can you serve someone out-of-state out of Maryland? You can, right? You can have jurisdiction over somebody if you serve them out-of-state. Sure, you can have personal jurisdiction over somebody. So one way, out of service on the defendant outside of Maryland may also be made in a manner approved by the court or permitted by local law, permitted by the state that you're serving him in, but only if it is reasonably calculated to give actual notice. Here's a real case. 30, the state of Virginia allows service by regular U.S. mail. Okay, so plaintiff mails the process to the defendant who contends she didn't receive it. This process okay?
Well, didn't deliver it personally, didn't deliver it personally to someone at his house, didn't send it by certified mail, but he sent it by out-of-state method that was allowed by Virginia. Maryland court says no good. NG. Why?
I'll tell you why. It says no, a Maryland court has held that such service is not reasonably calculated to give actual notice. A Maryland court has held that such service is not reasonably calculated to give actual notice. So generally speaking, what the another state says is going to go for service in that state, but the court is still going to ask itself, is this reasonably calculated to give notice? Okay, if we have an evasive defendant, right? The defendant resists, okay, by threats, violence or force, or process server is prevented from entering the premises, what can you do? You can deliver it, okay? Substitute delivery, deliver it to a responsible person at the premises. Printing came out of the hand. Okay. B, you can nail it. You can nail it to a place as near as possible, right? So if the guy's threatening you, you take the process, you go up to the telephone, you nail it in there, and you go, and you're off and running. Okay? That's special method for evasive or violent defendants. If none of these is working, there's a court-ordered method. You go to the judge, you say, listen, I wish there was some way to get this guy under some of the methods listed, but it just ain't working. Can you help me out? And the court has the authority to fashion something in particular for the situation. Okay. Now, who has to be served? Okay. Well, if it's an adult, you know, we got to just serve that person, right? Okay. Here's a hypo that gives a little variation on that. Question 31. Plaintiff named husband and wife as defendants to a complaint. A single copy of process, summons a complaint, is sent certified mail to the defendant's home. Husband signs a certificate of delivery. Has wife been properly served? No. Okay? Each defendant must be separately served. If a child is involved in a lawsuit, you're going to serve the child and the defendant, the child and his parent, guardian, or fiduciary. If it's a corporation, you're going to have the abstract. You need not memorize it, but there's a pecking order that you have to go through, remember, in order to figure it out. Your first choices are the resident agent, right, the one they appointed to serve process on, or the president, secretary, or treasurer of the company. Okay, if none of those work out, you go down some further down on the list, director, the vice president, etc. Okay? If that doesn't work, you're going to look at the extract. So you can't just keep going on, but there's a long list. Partnership, you serve any general partner. If it's a limited liability company that has a resident agent, you got to try to serve the agent first. These others aren't going to come up, but just in case, an unincorporated association, serve any officer or member of the board of that association. If there's no members of the board, you serve a member of the association itself. State of Maryland, you serve the attorney general. Okay, once you have the process, once you've done your job and you've served it correctly,
there's something called a return of service that needs to be, that should be filed with the court rather. It has to be filed by the process server, or you just hand in the certified mail receipt. If there is no process server, you did it by sending it by certified mail. If you don't file for proof, it doesn't affect validity of service. Okay, so it's something that they tell you to do, but if you don't do it, there's no real problem. Really downside. Challenging service. Defendant may attack two aspects of service. Remember this. Insufficient process. The process itself states that the pieces of paper that were issued, something's wrong with that. The summons is dormant is the leading example that's tested, right? It's old, 460 days old. But there's some sort of defect in the papers, okay? They weren't written up correctly. They were omitting needed information. The other thing is insufficient service of process, which is the more likely problem to go wrong. Didn't serve right, served the wrong party, improper server, that type of thing. Because if you have a question, you're going to try to figure out whether the service is proper. You're going to think about the process itself, whether it's dormant, and you can go through all these rules, okay? Did the guy who served, was he allowed to serve it, okay? Did they serve it in the proper manner? Did they serve it on the right person, that type of thing. Okay, timing. Either defense must be asserted by a preliminary motion to dismiss or it is waived. It's just like personal jurisdiction and venue, okay? Service of process, insufficient process, and insufficient service of process are things that our defendant has to assert up front in a preliminary motion. If he doesn't do it, they got it. Okay. Here's a little test. Question 32. Paul files this complaint on January 10th. Right? And leaves the complaint and summons with the defendant's son at her home on March 20th. If defendant timely moves to dismiss on all available defenses, how should the court rule? There are three things possibly wrong here. What are they? One, anybody?
Dormant.
Dormant summons. One, process is over 60 days old, so it's dormant. If you see the dates in there, that's what they're doing. Two, Paul is a party and he can't serve his own complaint. Almost anybody can serve the complaints at the party. Two, Paul is a party and can't serve his own complaint. Three, unless the son is of suitable age and discretion, right, and resides there, service on him is ineffective. Three, unless son is of suitable age and discretion and resides there, service on him is ineffective. Okay, once process is served, our defendant has a few choices available to him or her. He can make motions attacking the complaint, the pleading, or he can put it in answer. One thing you have to remember is that if he has some grounds, okay, that need to be asserted up front, okay, venue, personal jurisdiction, service of process itself, he needs to start with a preliminary motion. He needs to do it there. If he doesn't do it there, he lost. He puts in his answer and decides to do it, he can't do it. It's finished. Okay, so this is how it works. Okay? Basic concept is we know what a pleading is, right? A pleading is a document filed by the party setting forth the claims and responses. What's the difference between a pleading and a motion? A pleading is when the party is setting out the allegations, the things that they intend to prove at trial, right? The plaintiff will make his allegations in the complaint, the defendant will come back with an answer responding to those allegations. The defendant may also have counterclaims. Though that's what pleadings are, setting out the groundwork, the framework for the lawsuit. A motion is when you go into the court asking the court to do something for you. It's a request for an order, okay? A motion is saying to the court, hey, there's a problem here with our lawsuit. We need you to step in and tell us how to resolve it. Pleadings, okay? They have to have certain rules that they must comply with. Let's number them. It's one, form pleadings generally. One, pleadings must use numbered paragraphs with one allegation per paragraph, right? What does that mean? If you have a breach of contract loss claim,
First, Howard is going to say, on such and such a date, Joe and John entered into a contract for the sale of property, blah, blah, blah. Second, another paragraph, let's just talk about the breach. On such and such a date, so-and-so breached it by failing to deliver the property, blah, blah, blah. Third, one has to do the other claim, the other element. As a result of the breach, so-and-so suffered damages of. Each allegation must be in a separate numbered paragraph. Causes of action must be set out separately in distinct counts. What does that mean? I may have, from one set of facts, I have several claims. I may have a claim for negligence. I may have a claim for breach of consortium. I may have a claim for negligence, infliction of emotional distress. Each claim has its own set of elements. I have to, in my complaint, in my plea, set out count one, negligence. List out the facts. Count two, negligent infliction of emotional distress. List out the numbered paragraphs. So not only do I have to have numbered paragraphs, I have to separate, okay, out particular causes of action that I have. If I have a defense, I got to state them separately in another paragraph. Paragraph 27, the plaintiff's claim is barred by the applicable statute of limitations. Paragraph 28, plaintiff's claim is barred because of court satisfaction, whatever it is, but you have to state it separately. Pleading in the alternative is okay. What is pleading in the alternative is okay? It means I don't know what's going on at this stage of the lawsuit because I haven't done my homework. I'm the, for instance, representing the estate of my husband, and they allege that he was inebriated. So I'm going to allege, no, he wasn't inebriated, but I'm also going to plead the bar owner and say he was the one who caused it to be inebriated. That's inconsistent, right? But that's okay, because I don't really have a basis for knowledge at this point. Pleading and the alternative is okay. Pleadings are allegations. They must not argue or necessarily refer to the law. You file pleadings with the court. Service. How do you serve pleadings? Well, the first time you serve a plea, you look at the part that we just did. The first time I set that process on you, the first time I bring you into the lawsuit as the defendant, I got to do what I did in the prior part. Everything else, once you're the plaintiff, once you've been made part of the lawsuit by service of a process on you, then everything else usually just gets served by mail. Usually served on the attorney for the other party. That's how that works. So if you have original service, like of a complaint, okay, or a third-party complaint, you look at the prior rules. The rest of it, we're going to go through the rules for serving parties once they've already been brought into the lawsuit. Everybody get the distinction I'm making? Okay. Let's look at 33 just to understand the distinction a little bit more. P sues D for negligence. Believing that T is liable for all or part of P's claim, right? It's a claim over, an indemnity claim. He decides to serve a third-party complaint on T. How must T be served? Is it to be served by the rules I just talked about? Is it to be served with process? Yes, he does. It's process, right? He's just being brought into the lawsuit. It's process. So T must be served in the same manner as a defendant would be served with a complaint. It's process. So T must be served in the same manner as the D would be served with a complaint, as the defendant would be served with a complaint. Okay. Now, there's going to be a lot of stupid questions, maybe, okay, and the essence about when you have to send papers back and forth. Okay, so we're going to give you a maddening rule. You're tired. I know it's late. I know you want to go home, but you're going to hang in there just for like a half hour more. Okay, so we're going to get some of these rules under our belt. So when we see them again in the summer, we're going to say, oh, yeah, I remember that stuff. It's not so hard the second time around. If I'm going to respond to the complaint, okay, if I'm responding to process, right, here I am. I'm the guy with the complaint, right? And we have a certain amount of time to determine when you, the defendant, have to respond to it. What do I look at? I look at the date you get it. Not the date it leaves my hand. I look at the date you get it. So if I put it in the mail and we measure the time, it's measured from the date you open that mailbox and take it out. Of course, if I deliver it to you personally, it's the same day, right? But if it's by mail, you're looking at the date. You're always looking at it, process, the date the person received it. For all other papers, we don't look at that. Okay, we measure the date as of the date it leaves my hand. So if I'm responding, if I'm sending an answer back, okay, when do I serve it? When I put it in the mailbox or when he gets it? Well, it's when it leaves my hand, okay, because it's not there. So there's two distinct set of facts, okay? If it's process, right, a complaint,
We look at it when it hits the other person, when they get it. If anything else, we look at it when I put it in the mailbox. Stupid distinction, but that's the distinction that's made. Now, when I'm serving my answer on you, I could do two things. I could put it in the mailbox, or I could just hand it to you. If I put it in the mailbox, it's deemed served on that day. So if I had to put it in the mailbox by January 1st, I serve it when I put it in the mailbox on January 1st. You have 3 extra days to respond. So even though it's deemed served on January 1st, you have to respond within 15 days. You got 15 plus 3. Let me just say it all again. Complaint. Originally, service of process. I got to measure it from the date that the defendant gets it in his or her hands. Okay? We don't do any mailbox rule, anything like that. No waiting 3 days. All other papers, okay, once the parties are all part of the lawsuit, we measure time to respond from the date that it leaves the party's hand, the date the guy puts it in the mailbox, okay? We add 3 days to it, though, if he puts it on the mail in the mailbox as opposed to it. Still a little hard to follow, so let's just do a few hot blows to get it into our heads. Okay. Question 34. He serves a summons and complaint by certified mail. He puts it in the mailbox on September 1st. D receives it on September 3rd. By what date must D file his answer? Well, let's say he has 30 days. The question to ask yourself is, what's the controlling date here? Is it the September 1st date, or is it the September 3rd date? What's the controlling date?
September 3rd.
What?
3rd.
Why? Because it's the date that the defendant receives, right? The controlling date is September 3rd. So we have 30 days from the date that the defendant receives it, which brings you to October 3rd. Let's do something that's not processed, the other side of the other rule. D serves a preliminary motion on P, right? He's already in the lawsuit, but I put it in the mail on October 15th. P receives it on October 16th. If P must respond within 15 days after being personally served, by what date must he do so? Well, you gotta say, well, what's the controlling date in this situation? So this all other papers, the controlling date is the day it leaves my hands. So the controlling date is October 15th. Well, what do we have to remember when I put it in the mailbox for this second scenario? He had 3 days to it, right? So the controlling date is October 15th. Yeah, if you're not getting it, it's just because you're tired. Just write it down, go through it, and you get it when you get home. Controlling date is October 15th. So D has 15 days plus 3 for the mailbox rule. So D has 15 days plus 3 for the mailbox rule. That's 18 days. Which brings him to October 33rd. November 2nd. That's how I have to do it. I just have to keep adding, and then I figure, well, where does the month really end when I start? I say in my little tiny brain, October 33rd, and then I work it into November 6th.
Let's look at 36. D serves a preliminary motion on P by hand on October 17th. It's by hand. If P must respond within 15 days after personally served, by what date must he do so? Well, it's October 17th is the date. Day he got it, day he left my hands, the same thing, doesn't matter. So it's October 17th is when I left my hands, plus 15 days brings you to October 32nd, which is really November 1st. Let's assume that P's got to respond to D makes a preliminary motion, serves his papers, right, on November 2nd. Okay. Let's figure it out. No matter how it is, he serves it on November 2nd. If he intends to respond by mail, okay, by what date must he put the papers in the mailbox? Assume that P must respond by November 2nd. So what does that mean if I have to respond by November 2nd? Do I have to put it in the mailbox by November 2nd, or do I have to add 3 days? I have to put it in the mailbox by November 2nd. So November 2nd is the date. I calculated, I figured out I'm going to have November 2nd to respond. You only have 3 days to get from the point I'm putting it in, right? You know?
That's just, sometimes people get confused, so I added that in.
Sometimes a court ruling might require response to the filing. You asked to amend something, the court said no, they give you 15 days to do so. Do you add the mailbox rule? Not for the court. Why? It's the court. Okay? Mailbox rule doesn't apply. If the due date comes on a Saturday, Sunday, or holiday, you just talk it over. That makes sense. Question 38. Defendant receives a complaint by certified mail. Return receipt requested on November 25th. He must respond in 30 days. When do we calculate it from? If we get it, right? Got it on November 25th. He's got to respond within 30 days. What day must he do so? Well, he's got to do so on the first day after December 25th. That's not a Saturday or Sunday. Note there's no mailbox rule for complaints if you're thinking about that, right? That's the other thing. That's for non-processing. The answer is first day after December 25th. That's not a Saturday or Sunday.
Correct.
Mailbox rule does not apply for service of summons and complaints. You should understand that by now. But if not, that's a reminder to go back and make sure you understand it. Question 39. The court denies your motion to dismiss the complaint on August 8th. If you have 15 days to answer, when is your answer due? Doesn't matter how the court puts it in. It's October 23rd. No mailbox rule. Okay. What happens? You would think they have to go through all these calculations that if the person really actually failed to do within the time, they would be doomsday. They would shoot him or something. But no, what happens usually is the court says it's okay. Right, so if a pleading or motion is filed beyond the allowed time, you can move to strike it. You can say, but they were late, I'm going to move to strike it. However, if the tardy move can show there's no prejudice from the delay, the court's going to deny the motion. Hardly ever prejudice. Okay. Let's talk about, what do we talk about generally? We talked about papers, right, and how they have to be served, et cetera. Now let's talk about what has to be, and we talk about pleadings generally, what needs to be in there. One form of a pleading is a complaint. Let's talk about what we need to put in our complaint. 15 minutes to go. Let's talk about what we need to put in our complaint. Maryland requires the following has to be in, okay? You must allege that the amount of controversy satisfies jurisdiction. So there must be something in there that lets the court know that you're in circuit court for the right reason. You need to contain a clear statement of the facts necessary to constitute a cause of action. What does that mean? Well, when you have a complaint, when you're drafting a complaint, you're asking yourself, what are the elements of my claim, right? And when you draft your complaint, you have to make sure you allege a fact that shows that particular element has been met. If it's not, if you don't do that, your complaint is insufficient and is subject to a motion to dismiss. So that's what that second thing means. If he's demanding a money judgment, he's got to include the amount sought, relief in the alternative, maybe demand. If you're looking for punitive damages, you got to say so. Here's two things that don't have to be in it. 40 and 41. Let's look at it. P wants to sue D for breach of contract. Must P allege that D had capacity to enter into the contract? Is that part of what P needs to set out in his complaint? No. No need to allege capacity of parties. Question 41. P wants to sue D for breach of contract. Must P allege that he fulfilled all of his obligations under the contract? No need to allege satisfaction of conditions proceeding. No need to allege satisfaction of conditions proceeding. That's what those are, right? If you choose to do so, right? If P chooses to do so, he need only do so generally. If P chooses to do so, he need only do so generally. He just has to say, I satisfied all the conditions preceding. If P chooses to do so, he need only do so generally. Okay, a couple of things. Now I'm the defendant. I got served with my summons and complaint. I have a few choices available to me. I can make a motion, or I can put in an answer. A motion is I'm saying there's something wrong here. I don't even have to put in my answer. I should get out of this lawsuit right now. Okay.
There are two preliminary motions, two motions, shouldn't call it preliminary, two types of motions that are sort of not that often used, but we're going to talk about that. And then we're going to be talking about the main motion that we make at this stage, which is the preliminary motion. The two motions that are really not that often used is the motion for a more definite statement and a motion to strike. A plea is too vague or ambiguous to answer, right? The other side, the other term is on draws 23 after it, right? You might file a motion for a more definite statement. It's granted, and the corrected pleading is not filed within 15 days for a constructive pleading. But there's too much in it. The pleading contains improper material. There is later, violates the rules. A party can file a motion to strike within 15 days. Okay. Preliminary motions. That's the other thing that the defendant has to think about doing before puts in his answer. Because if he puts in his answer and he has what's one of these mandatory defenses in the preliminary motion, he's sunk. He's waived it. It's gone. Okay? There's a list there. There's a mnemonic. You can try to remember it if you want. But for the most part, it's pretty self-explanatory because you probably already understand it. When you can and when you cannot forget to assert these defenses. The mnemonic is this. My parents very severely punished Paul for doing really decent stuff. Okay? It's hard one to remember. So, well, mandatory defenses, the first group of letters. We know what the mandatory defenses are already. Personal jurisdiction is lacking. Venue is improper. Service of process is insufficient. Process is insufficient, right? It's dormant. There are other things you can bring up in a preliminary motion. Failure to state a claim, discharge in bankruptcy, required person not joined, immunity for government defendant, subject matter jurisdiction lacking. What do these, all of these things have in common when you think about it? They're all non-starters, right? They're all like, we're not even getting to the answer. That's what this is about. This is what a preliminary motion is about. How many preliminary motions can you make? One. Right. If the opposing party wants to file papers in opposition, he's got to file papers within 15 days. How do motions work? Motions are like a little dance, right? A dance on paper. I set up my motion papers on the other side. They file their response to motion papers. Sometimes there's a chance for the original movement to put in more papers. The judge reads the papers, decides the motion. Okay? That's how the preliminary motion and all other motions work. Let's look at questions 42, 43, 44, and 45, which test our knowledge of what preliminary motion is about. Preliminary motions are very important. You know why? For essay purposes? Just think about it. If I want to make a question that includes subject matter jurisdiction, process, venue, etc., okay, I just put in a whole bunch of facts related to all those things, have them pick venue here, have them do this there, have them serve it in an odd way. And then I say, you're the defendant, you want to make a preliminary motion to assess all relevant grounds. Okay? And then you have to go through all those things, and you have to make sure you state them. You have to know what the grounds for a preliminary motion are. So a preliminary motion is a great gateway, okay, for the examiners to test a whole bunch of different things. So when you see preliminary motion, you're like, whoa, okay, there's a lot of stuff I got to get thinking about. Question 42. Pat sues Dan. Dan files a timely preliminary motion to dismiss for insufficient service of process. The Maryland court denies the motion, right? After which Dan files and serves his answer, asserting as a defense his lack of jurisdiction, personal jurisdiction, and improper venue. Okay, time to bring out that malpractice claim, right? D waived it. Can you do it? No. D waived them, right? They must be asserted in the preliminary motion. Question 43. Assuming his answer, Dan asserts as a defense failure to join Becca as a required person to the suit. Well, that's one of the ones on our list, but it's permissive. He can make it in the preliminary motion, he can put it in his answer, he can make it right before trial, it's okay. Is it okay? Yes. The permissive defenses need not be made in the preliminary motion. That's what we're about. 44. God bless. What if, in his answer, Dan raises the defense of failure to state a claim upon which relief could be granted? Yes. Okay? Same reason. Permissive defenses
can be raised until trial. Question 45. On appeal, Dan moves to dismiss because the court lacks subject matter jurisdiction. On appeal, he figures it out. Is it okay? Yes, this defense is available. The defendant, okay, has put in his preliminary motion. Defendant makes any questions so far? Questions? Okay. Defendant puts in his preliminary motion. Court grants it. That's the end of the lawsuit. Puts in his preliminary motion. The court denies it. He's going to put in his answer, okay? If D does not file a preliminary motion, or if it's unsuccessful, he's going to have to file an answer. District court is called a notice of intention to defend, not an answer. But you don't have to worry about it because you're going to need to serve court. Timing, 30 days after in-state service of process if there's no preliminary motion. If there is a preliminary motion, then the defendant has 15 days after the court denies the motion. Okay, so if the plaintiff serves a complaint and you come back with a preliminary motion, you don't have to serve the answer, okay, until you get the court's denial of your preliminary motion. What do you do when you get the complaint? Well, you gotta do a few things. You either gotta admit it, okay, go through each of the allegations in the complaint. Remember, the complaint is a list of nothing allegations. You go through each one of them. You admit it, you admit it, you deny it, or you say you don't know about it. You deny information and believe to make an assessment of whether it's true or not. Okay? Failure to deny is an admission. So you don't even have to say you admit. You just leave it out and then they know that you admit it. Can you put in a general denial? What's a general denial? You just say, I deny everything, right? General denial. Just write a general denial. That's permitted in certain cases. Factual allegations of tort, contract, and debt action seeking limited damages can be answered with a general denial. So that does that mean you don't have to go through the process of figuring out, I admit this, I deny that, blah, 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 blah. Couple other things you do in your answer is besides responding to all the allegations of the complaint, okay, you can assert defenses. There are certain things they call negative defenses. They're things that really the plaintiff should have brought up, but we don't make the plaintiff bring them up because usually everyone takes them for granted that it's right, but the defendant can bring it up. If he thinks, okay, any of these are an issue, he's got to bring them up. Capacity, remember we said he didn't have to list capacity? Well, if the defendant thinks his capacity, it's a problem, he's got to bring it up. If he's being sued by a representative and he thinks that person suing doesn't have authority, he's got to bring it up. If there's a contract involved and he thinks he didn't sign it, he's got to bring it up. If there's a car collision, right, and he's not the owner of the vehicle, and he's got to bring it up. Okay. You can bring any of the permissive defenses that haven't already been made in the preliminary motion. You can bring them up there. Those are the leftover defenses. Then there are the things called the affirmative defenses. The affirmative defenses are listed. You'll get a list of them in the extracts, so you don't have to worry about it. But what you need to know is the affirmative defensive is generally something that would be surprising to our plaintiff if we'll just raise the trial. So we want to make sure, the law wants to make sure that the plaintiff has awareness of it. It's not saying, I don't think your claim is right, it's true. It's saying, even if it is true, it's barred by the statute of limitations, or we already went through this in another lawsuit, so res judicata applies. Okay. Affirmative defenses. D has the burden of proving and pleading affirmative defenses. It's D's job, okay? Failure to plead an affirmative defense in the answer weighs the defense, and all evidence relating to it may be excluded from trial as irrelevant. Leave to amend an answer to add an affirmative defense is freely granted to change the law. 30 days before trials, right there. 30 days before trials, they just amended it. Leave to amend the answer for 30 days before trial. So it's at the bottom of page 36, it should be 30. Okay, we got 5 minutes left. I'm really very proud of you. Okay, you're doing a good job. So just hanging it for 5 minutes more. Question 46. P sues D for breach of contract. D answers, denying the material allegations. At trial, D seeks to introduce evidence that the contract was procured by fraud and is therefore unenforceable. I'm going to tell you that's an affirmative defense. It's on the list in the extracts. P objects. Okay? Is that evidence admissible? Okay, that there's fraud. Is it admissible? No. Because fraud is an affirmative defense, evidence of it cannot be introduced at trial if not raised as an affirmative defense in the answer. No, because fraud is an affirmative defense, evidence of it cannot be introduced at trial if not raised as an affirmative defense in the answer. But, you know, if it's not put in the original answer, you get the court, as I said, the court's going to have a lot of leeway to demand. Okay, plaintiff may respond with a motion to strike any of the defenses, blah, 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 so he can come back with that. Counterclaims and cross-claims, let's just talk about that for a few minutes. Counterclaims and cross-claims are all permissive. So you sue me. I'm the defendant. You sue me. I have a claim back against you. Do I have to assert it? No, I don't have to assert that claim. Counterclaims are permissive. You sue two defendants. I have a claim against one of the my co-defendants. That's not a counterclaim. That's a cross-claim. Is it permissive? Yes. I don't have to do it. In other words, if it were mandatory and I didn't do it, I would have waived my right to bring that in a subsequent action. Counterclaims and cross-claims are all permissive. Having established that, let's talk about what type of counterclaims you can assert. Okay, I don't have to assert anything. But what can I assert? If I'm a defendant and I want to assert a counterclaim against the plaintiff, does my counterclaim have to be related to the plaintiff's claim? No. There's no requirement, okay, that a counterclaim, okay, be transactionally related, arise from the same transactional occurrence as the plaintiff's claim. Now, what if there's a cross claim? A defendant wants to sue a cross claim. Is it need to be transactionally related? Yes. Okay. So those are our rules that we need to understand. Okay. Let's look at question 47. Jerry borrows a Lay's car and then crashes into George's car. Right? George sues Jerry. So George is our plaintiff. He sues Jerry and Elaine for personal injuries. Jerry defends the suit, and he also wants to make a claim against George, the plaintiff, for repayment of money that George borrowed for a lifetime gym membership. Is this okay? Yes. Counterclaims do not have to be transactionally related to peace claim. In the hypo above, may Jerry also sue Elaine for failing to maintain her brakes properly. This is a cross claim. Jerry wants to sue a co-defendant, Elaine, for failing to maintain the brakes properly because it was a car crash. It's her fault, not his. Yes, because this cross claim arises from the same transaction or occurrence. May Jerry add a claim against Elaine for slandering him to her girlfriends? No, this cross claim does not relate to the same transactional occurrence. Same T/O, if you want to write it quickly. Okay? So I promise it's quarter two. I hope this was a little bit helpful. And I will hopefully see you guys in the summer, right? If not, if I don't see you because you do something else, I wish all of you luck. And before, I think what I said, in the same illusion that the, like thinking you'd get a job, I think that was insensitive of me. I was trying to be funny, but I know it's not a funny matter. So if you think my heart doesn't go out to you guys, it does. So I apologize for that. In any event, have a good weekend on Tuesday.